Hello again, Luke Clancy here, welcoming you to a special edition of the Culture File Weekly. Special as in different, but also special as in good, of course. This week, I'm walking again alongside the unique alignment of chancers, charities, choristers and 18th century it girls that somehow resulted in the Irish capital being the venue for the world premiere of Handel's most enduring creation, The Messiah. One of the many, many areas which the late historian Jonathan Barden explored so successfully in his work was the constellation of events that made this happen at Fishamble Street in 1742. So for the next half hour, we will all wander again a few small blocks of central Dublin in the company of the late Jonathan Barden, ambling backwards in time to the capital in the 1740s, back to the days when a visitor from the lowlands of Germany, by way of London, briefly entered Dublin society and, it's fair to say, made a bit of a splash. We begin a short walk from Fishamble Street at Christchurch Cathedral, a location that has its own place in the story of Handel's Messiah and the charity that enabled that first performance.
Maybe you'd tell us about where we're standing now. Now it is only known as Christchurch Cathedral, and we're standing outside the nicely appointed visitors' centre. But like many Dublin locations in your book, it's a kind of palimpsest. There's various layers of history and occupation under the spot.
Yes, in the 1740s, this was Christchurch Yard, and it was an amazingly cramped area. All four courts, which are now on the other side of the Liffey in a magnificent building, were crammed in here, and there were numerous shops. And on the west side, you came through an archway called Hell, and there you were. And if you were tried, you went out the other archway into Fishamble Street and were taken down to where the corporation offices are now, the council offices are now. And you were put into the forecourt Marshalsea, which was the prison. But one of the shops in this tiny area was owned by John Neill. And he and his son, William Neill, were the leading lights of the Charitable Musical Society for the Release of Imprisoned Debtors. And they sold musical instruments, they sold music, and they also raised funds to put up a music hall in Fishamble Street, halfway down it. And in fact, it was the biggest location of its kind in Ireland. It could seat 700 people. And they decided to open it in the autumn of 1741. But at that time, a terrible famine was sweeping Ireland. And the whole city was filled with paupers, people who had been impoverished by the destruction of crops, by storms and the great frost, as it was called, the year before. And they wanted to raise money for the release of these imprisoned debtors.
There were a lot of other problems around at the time, and this is exactly the period that Swift wrote his modest proposal about, also in Dublin.
Yes, I mean, Ireland was a deeply unequal society. In a way, Dublin benefited from this. The huge estates owned by the gentry now had Palladian mansions on them, but the people who were tenants and labourers on these were living on the edge of existence in many cases. And this was particularly true when, during the great frost, the potatoes froze in the clamps in the ground and the people were deprived of their food. Even the rivers froze over. They weren't able to fish. They weren't able to fish along the coast either. And a greater proportion of Irish people died in just 1 year, 1741, than died in the 4 or 5 years of the Great Famine a century later in the 1840s.
It's hard to imagine that glamour is the right word, but the later famine gets all the media attention.
The later famine is extremely well documented, that's why. But the entries for the famine of 1741 are extremely terse, but that does not mean it was not a terrible episode in the history of Ireland.
So Mr. Neal had his shop here. What kind of business went on there?
He imported all kinds of flutes, which actually for him were what we would now call recorders, but they were beginning to import what we now would call flutes played sideways, and a lot of violin strings, of course scores, and in fact the Neals were the first to print music, Irish music, including some work by the great harpist Turlough Carolan. But they were also leading members of Dublin society in organising entertainments in particular when the gentry came in during the winter from their country estates. They enjoyed meeting in taverns just to play music to each other, as people still do today. And I think that's where the idea of forming a charitable musical society emerged, particularly in the Bull's Head Tavern, which was in Fishamble Street.
So we're going to head from Christchurch Cathedral across the court here and down to Fishamble Street, which is named for exactly what it was.
It was a fish shambles, a place where fish were brought in from the Liffey and were gutted and sold. And that was the state of affairs from the reign of King John in the early 13th century all the way to the middle of the reign of Charles II in the 1660s. And then Sir Humphrey Jervis managed to persuade a Dublin corporation to move the fishmongers and the fish gutters and the skinners and the fleshers over to the other side of the Liffey, to the Ormond Market. And suddenly Fishamble Street, which had been a place where the upper classes would have avoided, suddenly became one of the most fashionable streets in Dublin.
And we'll head on down to Fishamble Street. The smell is almost completely gone now. So we're
We are at a bend in Fishamble Street, and it was here that the new music hall in Fishamble Street was built. Today there's only an archway, that's all that's left. In fact, there's really only one illustration of what the music hall looked like. There's that archway that I'm looking at now, plus there was an ironworks by the early 19th century called Kennan and Sons, and I'm very pleased to say that the Contemporary Music Centre of Ireland has decided to keep the doorway and indeed Kennan and Sons Limited.
It was a very good site for a music hall, because the resource that was particularly required for the Messiah were choristers of one sort or another, and the two cathedrals were just right by.
It would have been quite impossible to perform the sacred oratorio Messiah without the support of the choirs of Christchurch and of St. Patrick's. They were the professionals, and they weren't just boys. Mostly they were paid professional vicars choral, who would be able to read the music and interpret it straight away with the minimum of rehearsal. A lot of interesting documentation survives about the vicars choral and the stipendiaries who were hoping to become a vicars choral. They were not allowed to go to pubs, to taverns, but they frequently did, and quite often they missed rehearsals and missed performances, and they would be fined and that kind of thing. But nevertheless, it has to be said that in the end they were very good professional musicians.
So if we look through the gateway, there's kind of the interior courtyard of a block of flats. Is that the space of where the music hall was?
That is the space of where the music hall was, yes.
It's quite huge.
It's big enough for 700 people in the audience, so it was really quite large, yes, indeed. And there were boxes and archways and that kind of thing in it. But all we have are poetic descriptions, not any photographs or indeed drawings. We do know of certain people who were there. We certainly know that Dr. Patrick Delaney, who was rector of St. Werburgh's and chancellor of both Christ Church and St. Patrick's Cathedral, that Thomas Sheridan, the father of the famous playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan. Thomas Sheridan, in fact, was the manager of Smock Alley, which is just down the street, the theatre.
We say all those, the names and what was here and so forth, but is there any feeling for you of what was in this space? It's hard to get it now as the trucks roll by and the towering offices behind us and the coffee shops around us. It's hard to know that something special happened here.
I think it is hard to know, but that is true of so many places. At least we do have a nice plaque that I'm looking at on the building, the Contemporary Music Centre, Kennan and Sons. Perhaps the narrowness of the street, the twistingness of the street, gives some kind of impression of the old medieval city and the early Georgian city. So I can let my imagination rip a bit, I have to say.
So maybe we'll go inside the Handel Hotel and see if he's in there, in spirit.
Dublin had always been the city of the conqueror, you know, founded by the Vikings, and then the Anglo-Normans, headquarters of the Lordship of Ireland. It was where the administration operated from Dublin Castle, and it grew around government institutions. But nevertheless, its population was a mixed one. Some survivors from Viking Dublin, with names like Searson, many of them Normans, English. The men of Bristol in particular were encouraged to settle here. And by the 18th century, this was the second largest city in George II's Hanoverian dominions. It was actually bigger than Madrid, bigger than Berlin, about the same size as Milan. It thrived on trade, on the gentry coming in from their estates in the wintertime to spend money.
It seems like it was a neighbour of Handel's in Brook Street in London who first suggested that Dublin might be an interesting place for a composer of fashion to visit.
Yes, Mary Pendarve, she was a widow, and she had a house just a few doors down from Handel, and she came here. She was the daughter of a very powerful landlord, the Marquess of Lansdowne, and she had a wonderful time here, entertained frequently at Dublin Castle. She stayed with Bishop Clayton in St. Stephen's Green in the house, which is now Ivy House, the head of the headquarters of the Department of Foreign Affairs. And she came back from Dublin after a year and a half stay, rhapsodizing about what a great city this was and he should go there. Handel was led to believe that Dublin had the clientele, it had the musical resources to make sure that any music he put on would be well attended and well funded. You were charged half a guinea to get in. I did some kind of calculations. How much was half a guinea? And, it would be about something like 140 euro. You might say, well, that's not too much to pay to hear the first performance of a great work conducted by a great conductor. But you have to remember, most people in Ireland were paid no more than sixpence a day, and you'd be lucky to get work every day of the week. For many years, Handel had been a brilliant success in London, so much so that other composers found it difficult to make any headway at all. He specialised in Italian opera. And Italian opera meant that you had to bring over divas from Italy and castrati from Italy. But after a while, by the late 1730s, the gentry in London were really getting a bit tired of all of this. They felt that why do we have to go to operas which are always sung in Italian, which we don't understand? John Gay and his Beggar's Opera, sung in English, encouraged them to want something in English themselves and something a bit different. So Handel's career was faltering, in other words.
Alexander Pope suggested that he was kind of driven away from London to Ireland.
Yes, Pope wasn't all that interested in music. Nevertheless, he was appalled by many of those who criticised Handel. And he, in a long poem called The Dunciad, declared that Handel had been driven to the Hibernian shore by all that this ignorance in London, by mistress dullness and so on. So when the invitation came from the Charitable Musical Society for the release of imprisoned debtors, Handel probably thought, yes, maybe I'll give it a go, because that charity had allied itself with the Charitable Infirmary and with Mercer's Hospital. And Mercer's Hospital was perhaps the most respectable charity in the whole of Ireland. That meant that the government officials would have said, oh, yes, definitely something that we would approve of.
Surprising opposition to the charitable opening of the Messiah came from the dean at St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Jonathan Swift had been keen to become an English bishop, but he was also a Tory propagandist of great brilliance. But the problem was that when Queen Anne died, the Tories were in trouble and the Whigs came to power. And so when he was offered the lowlier position of being Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral, he seized it. So he comes over in 1715 and he's actually a very conscientious Dean of St. Patrick's. He saw that Christ Church Cathedral choristers were excellent. He saw that his own choir was appalling, and he spent many years bringing it up to the standard of Christ Church.
But by the time Handel arrived, Swift was a very old man, and it seems a very irascible old man. He was grumpy and not really putting up with anything.
There is no doubt that by 1740, 1741, Jonathan Swift should have been retired from the position of Dean of St. Patrick's. Nowadays, you'd say he had Alzheimer's. And he was extremely forgetful and quarrelled with all his friends. So when Handel, early in 1742, wanted to have the use of choirs, even for charitable purposes from St. Patrick's, Swift forbade it. And it was a very serious moment for Handel. He could not have put on Messiah without the professional, well-trained choristers of both Christ Church and St. Patrick's. You might say, well, could he not have done just with the Christ Church choristers? The problem was that many of those choristers, those vicars choral, were employed by both cathedrals. So if Swift forbade the use of choristers from St. Patrick's, that really meant that there could not be a performance of Messiah.
And we don't really know what happened, do we? We have the letter from Swift forbidding this to happen, and the next thing you know, it happens.
The interesting thing is that most of the other clergy involved, like the Reverend Matthew Pilkington, the Reverend Dr. Patrick Delaney, and the like, they were keen followers of contemporary music. So they used their influence to really sideline Swift and make sure he was looked after. But that was it. As Handel was preparing to return to London in the late summer of 1742, he decided he ought to call on Jonathan Swift. And a lady who was a very distinguished poet herself, who wrote quite lurid memoirs about Dublin society, her name was Letitia Pilkington, and she recorded in her memoirs, and I quote, "I was told the last sensible words he uttered were on this occasion. The servant was a considerable time ere he could make the dean understand him, which when he did, he cried, 'Oh, a German and a genius, a prodigy, admit him.' The servant did so just to let Mr. Handel behold the ruins of the greatest wit that had ever lived along the tide of time, where all at length are lost." A very famous contralto took part in the first performance of Messiah, Susanna Sibber, and her story is an extraordinary one. She begins as the daughter of an upholsterer and undertaker in London called Thomas Arne. He runs into financial difficulties. He decides to put his 17-year-old daughter on the stage, and she's a superb success right from the start. Then Daddy persuades daughter that she ought to marry the poet laureate's son, Theophilus Sibber. She takes one look at him and decides not really, but Daddy nevertheless insists. And so they are married. It's not a very successful marriage. He is a wild, dissolute man who has constant affairs. She gets venereal disease. She loses her first two children. But nevertheless, she is making money on the stage, and she's making money. He's sort of reasonably successful on the stage and as a stage manager, but she's making much more money than him, but he's spending it all. And he eventually decides he can raise money by introducing her to a gentleman called William Sloper. Sloper lends, in inverted commas, money to Theophilus Sibber. He is introduced to Susanna, and they get on extremely well, and in fact they become lovers with the full support of her husband Theophilus. But then they're so much in love that they decide they want to set up with each other for the rest of their lives, and this means that Theophilus is going to run out of a regular source of income from William Sloper, so he brings an extraordinary case against William Sloper for what is then called criminal conversation, in other words, having an illicit affair with his wife. And the trial was very, very public indeed, especially one man at the back of the court disobeyed the judge's instructions and took down what was said verbatim. And so people knew the graphic details about a man who hired them a room, boring holes through the wainscot to see what they were up to, and describing in graphic detail.
Mrs. Sibber is an artiste.
Common whore she is, and not a screed more than it.
She's to sing in the master's new work at Dublin. People pay good money to have her perform.
They certainly do, and go home satisfied.
Ah, Marjorie.
I think you fancy her yourself, you Barbado of lust. I saw you leering at her this morning.
The court decided to award Theophilus Sibber £10. That was an indication that they knew that Theophilus had encouraged this whole affair. So she disappeared then for 3 years into the countryside. Hardly anybody knew where she was. Her husband refused to allow her to appear on the stage, as he was then entitled to do. But then she got a letter. And this letter was from John Quinn. John Quinn was a great bear of a man, an Irishman who had made a great success playing various Shakespearean roles on the London stage. But he every now and then returned to Dublin. He was in Dublin, and suddenly he needed a leading lady at very short notice. He was a great defender of Susanna all through her career. He wrote to her, please come over. She couldn't bear not to come, so she came. But she hoped when she was in Dublin that nobody would know about her colourful past. She was quite wrong. Faulkner's Dublin Journal made sure of that. And on the first few nights on the stage at Anger Street Theatre, hardly anybody came. The gentry were afraid to come because of her scandalous past. But that's when the Duke of Devonshire steps in. He decides, right, he's going to have a command performance of a play with her as the star. So he goes with all his family once again, and so all of the rest of Dublin society goes as well. And from then on, Susanna did not look back. Handel decided to go and hear her. He'd already employed her in London on one or two occasions. He knew perfectly well she had a very thin voice, that she was not trained, she couldn't even read music, but she had wonderful dramatic presence, an affecting way of singing that he couldn't bear to be without her for certain bits of Messiah. She agreed to take part, and they presumably sat down where, we don't know, St. Michael's it could have been, and he would put her through the music and get her to learn it. And she certainly, we know, she moved the audience at the first performance of Messiah. How do we know this? Because we are told that Dr. Delaney, who knew all about her colourful past, was so moved by her singing of He Was Despised that he rose to his feet and declared, "Woman, for this be all thy sins forgiven." She went on to be a remarkable success in London. After her Messiah performance in Dublin, she returned to the stage, and her husband Theophilus shrugged his shoulders and allowed her to appear with David Garrick and others. Theophilus himself got his own comeuppance, by the way. He was actually, he took up with the wife of a merchant, I think it was, in Dublin. And so he was backwards and forwards between Dublin and London. And she was a bit of an actress herself. They were coming from Chester, from Parkgate, to sail to Dublin, and they got onto this leaky vessel. It was so leaky that some of the linen merchants got off, even leaving their money behind. The ship went down in the middle of the Irish Sea, and that was the end of him.
It's kind of a happy ending. The late Jonathan Barden there concluding this edition of the Culture File Weekly, and a further regiment of Georgian Dubliners involved instrumentally or accidentally in the Messiah premiere can be found wandering the pages of Jonathan Barden's book, Hallelujah, the story of a musical genius and the city that brought his masterpiece to life. The Culture File Weekly will be back next Saturday with a special Culture File debate with writers including John Banville and Sarah Baum talking about the birds in their life and their work. That's next Saturday, 6:30 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, hallelujah.